fix the problem, you can ask your question later on tonight. I'm sure we'll have some time. Okay, so I'll ask again if anyone has any questions of a technical nature, but before I do, I just want to revisit a topic that Wesley brought up last week. He wanted to discuss the difference between acoustic, air-based sound waves and electromagnetic excitation RF waves. And I kind of pondered in my head of what the heck you could, how high could you make an acoustic wave in an air medium? I mean, theoretically, you know, the sky is the limit, I guess. But the problem is that air is such a interesting media that if you bang on it too loudly, it's going to have nasty repercussions. And I just kind of felt that there was some significant limitation in the acoustic air-based waves that you could manifest. And I did a little research over the week, and apparently there is. It's not a cut and dry thing. There's no definitive cutoff. What happens is the free space attenuation of acoustic airwaves, the attenuation goes up dramatically as you raise the frequency. So apparently there's some difficult to find article from someone who actually took a transducer and ginned it up to 10 megacycles. And got an acoustic sensor, and he could not receive any of those acoustic signals beyond 2 millimeters. So that's how badly the free space attenuation for very high frequency of acoustic air-based medium sound waves have. So there is a limitation. It's due to the nature of gases. All that force will tend to superheat the gases and disrupt any kind of pressure wave that they might be generating. So I was curious about that and looked it up, and so I thought I'd share with the audience.
And to exchange.
Yes, Wesley.
Okay, from the description, is this about adiabatic compression and decompression? I don't know how to pronounce properly the word adiabatic, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I think it's adiabatic.
Adiabatic. Okay. So the medium is the factor limiting the frequency of acoustic waves. So acoustic wave is a mechanical wave. Has nothing to do with any property that is assigned to electromagnetic wave. Absolutely different species. And whenever we have acoustic waves, we never have electromagnetic waves caused by acoustic waves. True or false?
Well, I am sure that there is some way of finagling that, because you could strike a piezoelectric element with a sound wave and force pressure waves of compression that will generate electricity. And if you do it in a way that alternates, they will emit RF.
Anybody else could share their opinion? So the statement was, actually it was a statement, it was a statement question. Can acoustic wave create electromagnetic waves? And to exchange. Okay, it looks like nowhere. Dr. Roy, how come you always write? You have a speaker. If you blow air into your speaker or start to talk to your speaker, what do you think is happening to the coil at the end of the speaker? Dr. Roy.
Yeah, that's another example. But probably we should broaden this discussion as much as possible to make it easier for everyone to understand that ultimately this is just another aspect of the conservation of energy, where you can change one form of energy into another form of energy. The laws of nature allow you to do this. And pressure waves have their own energy. So it is possible to engineer a device that will convert pressure waves into other forms of energy. You'll be able to, theoretically, I'm sure, you could charge a battery with enough noise. But these transducers do exist, and a lot of energies are transferred from all kinds of forms to all kinds of other forms. Kinetic, potential, chemical, I can go on and on and on. So this is more of a small niche in the bigger picture of the laws of conservation of energy.
Okay, so question number two. If acoustic waves and electromagnetic waves are so different, why do they have a similar properties in terms of period and amplitude? And why both of them can create standing waves? And to XGM.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, as far as the standing wave is caused by the interference of two waves. For example, if it's an acoustic wave, you can get a standing wave, for example, in an organ pipe as the sound wave reflects from one end and interferes with the wave coming towards that end. So you have the wave coming and the reflected component. That causes the standing wave. With electromagnetic waves, again, it's the same thing. A reflected wave from a, say, a shorted a transmission line interferes, the forward wave interferes with the reflected wave, causing the standing wave. So you get standing waves from constructive and destructive interference of the wave moving in two directions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. Getting back to Wesley's question, there are a lot of forms of energy that have wave-like characteristics. There are other forms of energy that do not. The problem that most people have with quantum mechanics is that a lot of quantum mechanical particle concepts, what have you, suffer from this wave-particle duality in which in some cases they act very wave-like, and in others they act very particle-like. So you do not necessarily have to be an electromagnetic wave to have wave-like properties. Gravitational waves have wave-like properties and have no electromagnetism in it either. So it is just a broad characteristic of some forms of energy and not others.
VDH with a recommendation?
Yes, John.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that video, Similarity of Wave Behavior. It's on the ATT Tech Channel. It's by Dr. Shive. It's a couple of years old. It was first done, I think, back in the early 60s or maybe late 50s, but it is a beautiful video, Similarity of Wave Behavior, on the ATT Tech Channel. That's by Dr. Shive. Go ahead.
Very good, John. Yes, I've seen it. I'm sure you've recommended it before, but I've seen it before. You can sort of tell that it's a film from the 50s, just by the professor's attire. He looks dressed very much for late 50s, early 60s.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Now I'm starting to look this stuff up. Ultrasound frequencies, they said they 2.5 megahertz if they're using it for ultrasound, and then they go all the way up to 15 megahertz they're looking for musculoskeletal imaging, 15 megahertz, that's way up there. I know I had one done for a carotid artery. I have no idea what the speed on that thing was. But, it, you know, that's high, you know. What was your limit that you came up with?
Well, the big difference is what is the medium that you're using. When you had your ultrasound, they put a glop of Vaseline-like material on the electrode and squished it over your neck so that there was no air in between. Air is not as conducive to ultrasonics. You could probably crank the ultrasonics in body tissue up to 25 megahertz and not have too many problems. But in the case that I was discussing, it was totally in air, and it was about 2 millimeters distance before this guy's sensors could not pick up any hint of a 10 megahertz acoustic signal.
Oh, okay, I got it. Very good. Understood. Yeah, that's true. You put it on your skin, and whatever's behind it is in air. Okay, thank you.
Question. Okay. Acoustic waves, they have a pressure, particle vessel velocity, particle displacement, and acoustic intensity. So acoustic waves could be explained by classical mechanics, while electromagnetic waves are not. And the question, why electromagnetic waves cannot be explained by quantum physics? Dr. Roy.
Okay, you got me confused on a bunch of different levels. Number one is electromagnetism. That was Maxwell's theory. It was rather rigorous. They didn't dot all the I's and cross all the T's. But I think they had a good sense of what electromagnetism was, and that was long before quantum mechanics. And then your next line is that quantum mechanics can explain electromagnetism. I think, again, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. They pretty much do. They'll have a different description, perhaps, as part of quantum field theory. They will say that the vacuum of space-time is filled with numerous quantum fields, and a local excitation of the electromagnetic field is what we perceive as an electromagnetic wave. So I'm not quite sure what you mean by the fact that the classical physics couldn't explain it. I mean, they had problems with its propagation, and they spent a lot of time and effort trying to design very, very clever devices to measure ether, which doesn't exist, so they didn't really succeed at that, but you know, they came close reasonably well, and I think they had a good idea, although some of the forefathers of electromagnetic wave theory, Hertz, had a famous quote where he didn't think that there was any real value in it as a means of making any kind of money. He thought it was an interesting thing that he discovered, but you couldn't monetize it. Little did he realize.
Acoustic waves travel with characteristic acoustic velocity. That depends on the medium they are passing through. Electromagnetic waves, they have their own velocity that depends on the medium they are passing through. But classical mechanics cannot explain why electromagnetic waves regain the speed after passing through the medium, as acoustic waves decays. True or false, Dr. Roy?
Well, like they say about Facebook and relationships, it's complicated. Light travels through space-time. Space-time has a causality velocity limit of the speed of light in a vacuum. That's why when light is traveling through a medium that has a speed of light limit, it travels at the speed of light. light really only travels at the speed of light. The idea that putting it into materials with higher optical densities slow down light is not really the precise explanation. What it does is the dielectric material interacts with the light, producing other electromagnetic waves that have phase distortions to the light, or to the electromagnetic wave going through it, to have a perceived velocity slowdown. And since it's not really slowed down, but just the interaction with the dielectric is giving that false appearance, once it exits the dielectric material, it then appears to speed up. It never slowed down.
But I specifically pointed that classical mechanics cannot explain that, while classical mechanics have no problem with characteristic acoustic velocity of sound wave that is never regaining anything, it's just decaying. True or false?
Well, once again, yes. The thing is, there's a good reason why quantum mechanics exists. Quantum mechanics exists because classical mechanics left a lot of things confusing and unknown. And there was a lot of attempts to explain it in classical terms that failed. And so quantum mechanics was conceived of and worked on a great deal, and can make predictions and explain a lot more than classical mechanics. Unfortunately, even the state of quantum mechanics today does not explain everything. Just recently, there was a discovery that the W boson is about twice as heavy as it theoretically should be from the most modern understandings of how quantum mechanics works. So they have to go back to the drawing board and figure out why the boson is as heavy as it is, apparently. So we haven't come to any kind of conclusion, but we're getting closer and closer to, hopefully, reality. But yeah, there are things that quantum mechanics helps us understand that without it we couldn't fathom at all.
In acoustic frequency damping, if we're dealing with two identical waves that are opposite in phase, we have cancellation of the noise. That could not be done with electromagnetic wave. That's another proof that classical mechanics can deal with issues quantum mechanics cannot, and reverse. A few words about that counseling. You may have better English than mine. Enter shit.
AC2GS, by the way. I once again, hate to disagree with you, Wesley. If you ever look at the slit, the two slit experiment in light waves, it produces interference patterns. The reason why it produces interference patterns is because it interferes positively and negatively with it. That's what waves do. So that's kind of the same sort of wave-like phenomena you're mentioning that acoustic waves do. I don't disagree with you about acoustic waves, but interference is certainly something in electromagnetism.
If you put a microphone in a certain point where you have a two incoming sound waves opposite in phase. So they are the same sound waves, they are just opposite in phase. At the point where you have your microphone, you will have a zero sound. That could not be achieved with two electromagnetic waves opposite in phase. Dr. Roy.
Well, once again, the slots kind of show interference. Now, can you arrange electromagnetic waves so perfectly that you can have them interfere completely and negate each other? It is probably something that is beyond our scientists and engineers. But theoretically speaking, again, The slit experiment kind of demonstrates the concept of interference, that in places where the phase difference is inverted, you don't have any light. So that's interference as far as I'm concerned. Again, you might not be able to do what acoustic waves do, because acoustic waves operate at much lower frequencies, and there are other aspects. But the wave-like principle of positive and negative interference occur with electromagnetism as well.
I have a problem with that explanation. Photon cannot interfere, cannot interact with another photon. We have two incoming waves, sound waves, in space. And those waves could cancel each other. So you have a complete quietness. You could stand in between them and you will hear zero, nothing. That cannot be done with two photons. Photon cannot interact with another photon. It doesn't see it. It can only interact with itself. True or false?
AC to PM.
Yes, Jeff.
I wonder if Wesley studied any crystallography.
Any what?
X-ray crystallography.
I don't have much experience with that. I did have that as a study, but I'm listening to your comments.
No comments, just wondering. But I think that you should listen to Dr. Roy, AC2PM.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for that comment. I just want to expand and refute what Wesley just mentioned to a degree. Yes, a photon will not interact with another photon. That's not what happens with the slit test. What's happening is the two photons, or even one photon, is interacting with the surface that is registering whether light hit it or didn't hit it. So this is not happening in a vacuum because photons need to interact with something. You can't detect a photon unless it interacts with something. A photon traveling in space, unless you have dust or something that's absorbing part of it, is invisible to any other angle but straight on where it's going. So in a way, yes, but in a way, no. Photons interact with your detector, and it's at the detector site that you see the interference pattern.
I agree with that. The only thing that I don't understand what crystallography has to do with that. I mean, it's like we're talking together, and did you read that book? Which book? That book. Ah, you should. And you didn't, then listen to Dr. Roy. I mean, you make a point. Try to defend your point to the point. That's my understanding. Dr. Roy.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think the comment about crystallography was that what happens, the crystal structure, because it is a regular repeating lattice, incoming X-rays can generate interference patterns as they propagate through the crystal and then go onto a detector. So again, you will see bright and dark bands on your detector due to the lattice structure of the crystal as the X-rays propagate through the crystal. I think that's what's meant by that. What happens in crystallography as they determine as they use X-rays to determine the lattice structure. So go ahead.
I would agree with you as well, John. Let me make sure that I have it. Okay. I would agree with you. Jeff was, I think, pointing out the fact that regularly structured crystals produce interference patterns. Very useful ones, too. This is how we were able to discern the structure of DNA. By looking at the poor woman X-ray crystallographer who died before she could get a Nobel Prize pattern, and figuring out that it is a a double backbone helical structure that produces that interesting interference pattern. So, anything with a wave characteristics can and will have an interference pattern. You might not be able to just neutralize everything, but I think that's a limitation of our technology and the different characteristics of different energy forms that utilize wave-like properties in their behaviors.
So we come to the point that there is a need for certain medium and certain conditions to exist in order to have a certain phenomena happen. When I start to talk about sound waves, we had unlimited space and two sound waves. Sound waves, they had just opposite polarity or phase. And that's what I was coming from. But I was for the past 20 years in EDS, or energy X-ray spectrography, and that was close to crystallography, but I was never as good in it. So I'm afraid that somebody could actually catch me on something that I don't understand. Let me drop. As a matter of fact, I have CECO 5120, which is the university grade, extremely, extremely accurate device, and works on the pattern that you are actually bombarding with X-ray the atom of the species. A device under test, and then it responds with its characteristic a photon that is created because you actually hit one of the electrons on the orbit, KLMN, let me drop. And that characteristic photon is a photon that has a frequency of, let's say, gold, or let's say iron, or let's say nickel. And that's how you are able to know which atom you're dealing with. In crystallography, they went a little bit deeper than that, and they were able not only to see the particle atoms, but actually bonds between the chemical structures. If we could call that, there is a chemical structure per se in the crystal. Dr. Roy.
Well, I don't think X-ray crystallography particularly is good for quantitative qualitative analysis. What the material is, it's primarily designed to try and assist people in figuring out the three-dimensional structure of the crystal lattices produced. So, different types of alignment of individual atoms will produce different interference patterns to X-ray sources, and by interpreting those patterns, you can interpret the internal structure of the molecules and crystals formed in the compound. So it's not going to tell you if it's nickel or barium or what have you, but it'll kind of tell you if it's cubic or hexagonal or somewhat more esoteric. As far as the lattice structure is concerned.
Yeah, actually, the EDXRF is very much similar to EDF that I have in my electron microscopes. The device looks different and it operates under different pressure. So let's say with the standard EDXRF, I can have no vacuum at all, or very little vacuum. So with electron microscope, I have to have 2.5 times Well, we call it high vacuum. Yes, high vacuum. Now, the inconvenience about that is that before you make a measurement, you have to vacuum it, and then if you want to spend exchange the specimen, you have to re-vacuum it again. As with EDXRF, the EDXRF is being used by most of the jewelry guys. I had a funny situation. One of the friends of mine, the jewelry guy, brought me like a big chunk of the gold, and it looks like it was taken out of some kind of furnace with all of those impurity on it. And he said, I'm gonna check you up. Yeah. So I put it into the device, and that was that Seiko 5120. And then I found lead, I found nickel, I found silver, and plenty of other things. And then he was so surprised, and he says, yes. And he looked at the quantity, because it was quantitative and qualitative measurement. He said, yes, that's right. I said, how do you know? Because I made it myself. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay. It's a very useful technology. Someone in the chat room mentioned that it's an interesting technology. Although it does use x-rays, it uses them different aspects of the x-ray. Rather than interpreting images where there's interference, it's just a means of a spectroscopic analysis of excitation sites of electrons and interpreting what the material is based on it. Let me just pause this conversation for 1 second, because I had spoken earlier to Ed about discussing a subject. I haven't heard him tonight, so. Ed, are you out there?
WD2DAZ.
Oh, good. Okay, Ed. So can I put you down for next up on the flight path? When we're done with this question, we can move on to you.
Sounds good.
Okay, very good. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't forget Ed. Who can forget Ed? So, Wesley. I understand, and I realize that you've done a lot of experimenting, and you have some of these devices. Sounds like a fun thing to play with. Anything else?
Yeah, just the last thing. The speed of gravitational waves in general theory of relativity is equal to the speed of light in vacuum. With the theory of special relativity, the constant C is not only about light, and instead it is the highest possible speed for any interaction in nature. So formally, C is a conversion factor for changing the unit of time to the unit of space. So this makes the speed, which does not depend on either the motion of an observer or source of the light and the gravity. So the question is that space statement true or false? And the second one, how gravitational wave differ from electromagnetic wave? I know it's silly, but it's a question. Back to you.
Okay, I'll take the second one, because I'm not 100% sure what the first one was, so I'll give you time to restate the first one. The second one is gravitational waves are distortions in the fabric of space-time. Electromagnetic waves are excitations in an electromagnetic field in space-time. So they're different characteristics entirely. Gravity is, I wouldn't say it's a force, because then you get into troubles with what that means. It's an interaction. It's one of the four known basic interactions we're aware of. the strongest being the strong nuclear force, then the electromagnetic force, then the weak nuclear force, and finally the weakest force is gravity. So there are different interactions, or we call them forces, but a lot of times if you read into relativity, you would perceive gravity not as a true force, but as a pseudo force. But it's easier to just say it's an interaction, and then you don't have to put any adjectives. So I hope that answers your second question. If so, could you restate your first question?
What I believe is, if I go to the entire set of questions that I have related to it, we're going to have people bored, and we're going really deep. There is a real person that is waiting for your answer, so maybe we can end it now and back to his bed later, maybe next time. And to next year.
Okay, fine, Wesley. So, Ed, you're on.
Am I the real person Wesley was just referring to?
Believe so.
Well, I take offense to that. I am purely imaginary.
I would worry if I was imagining you, Ed. By the way, for people who want to play at home, the diagram of the antenna that Ed is going to be discussing is available for you to look at if you don't have a QST magazine nearby. It's available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. So if you are curious about what it looks like schematically, that's as good a place to look for it as any, because I haven't found it by Googling it anywhere on the internet, which is an interesting thing for an antenna. But back to you, Ed.
Okay, Roy. Now, this is about an item. I got the, the May 2022 issue of QST in the mail yesterday. And on page 30 is an article that caught my attention. I spoke to Roy about it and thought maybe I just bounced this around on the internet today. It is a somewhat unusual but very simple design. But you basically, it's a 20 meter dipole. But what makes it unusual is it, the author took a long length of RG58U and 16 and a half feet from one end, which is, you know, quarter wave on 20 meters. He cuts off the shield and just leaves the center conductor. Then he measures another 16 and a half feet for another quarter wave, where he puts a little isolator circuit, and then, which does not break the coax. And then the coax continues down to the transmitter. So there's a transmission line up to the choke or isolator. Then you have quarter wave of coax as the one half of the dipole, and a quarter wave of the center conductor as the other half. And I thought this was a very simple and clever design. Now let me just check and let it drop, and then I will get into the design of the choke. The choke is, he just takes a toroid, specifically a T157-2 ferrite toroid. Apparently, I assume it's large enough to wrap multiple turns of RG58 around it, and takes the coax, wraps 9 turns of the coax around it. Then where the coax enters this and leaves it, he peels off the outer plastic covering to expose the braid and solders on an 82 picofarad capacitor, which is calculations confirmed by measurements, showed makes it a parallel LC trap that provides the, you know, the isolation, the signal to isolate the transmission line from the antenna. Anybody have any thoughts or comments at this point?
Ed?
Go ahead, Roy.
My understanding is it only isolates the outer shield, not the center wire.
Yes, you have to allow the transmitted signal to get out to the exposed quarter wave at the end.
Yeah, so in a way what's going on, at least the way that I see it, is that you're operating one of these quarter wave dipoles in the common mode, which is a fascinating way of configuring it, because in differential mode it wouldn't radiate, so the only way it would radiate would be in the common mode, and that's why the choke will block the signal going back. So that's a fascinating little extra there.
KG2R1.
David?
Good evening, Ed. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. Hope you're all having a fantastic holiday. Someone had given me the instruction of how to create a coil of RG58 around a ferrite core used to try to eliminate noise coming in to the receive end of the transceiver. Is this something close to what you described for the high Z choke on this antenna diagram? And I'm wondering if it's the same, if it has the same effect.
I really don't know. I can say this is intended to give you a proper SWR and a decent radiation pattern. I believe that was the only concern.
QSL. But, you know, you take this round ferrite core and you wrap 9 turns of RG58 around, you know. And it's the same exact thing for the receive end to eliminate noise on the receive end. I guess maybe, you know, it's pretty close to like an MFJ915 where, you know, you have a isolator choke and for the idea of keeping RF out of the shack.
Well, what I see it as, its primary purpose, it's minimizing RF feedback coming into the shack down the coax line, but it's sort of like, one other thing it might do is prevent freeze-line radiation to maintain the antenna pattern. Might also be necessary to maintain the SWR, which I have a question about. I'll bring up in a minute. But where I see this as being very, very useful, there are various ways of like using a slingshot or stuff like that to get a string way up in the top of a tree. And I can see this would be beautiful to just tie the end of this onto such a string and haul it up as high as you could possibly get it. And now you have a vertical antenna, which on AF, the HF, the polarization is not that important. Of course, you know, the atmospheric propagation plays games with the polarization. So verticals and horizontals aren't that really that big a difference like they are, say, on this frequency. But I can see it as mechanically a very interesting way of just pulling up something straight up, and it's very, very inexpensive to put together, and I feel that's the strongest point, so I thought I would mention it. Roy, I have another thought on it, but any comments?
KG2R1.
Yeah, David recognized, let me just put in my two cents. It's a fascinating design, and I'm sort of amazed that I can't find it anyplace else, and it has a very bad name. I at one point, I think he refers to it as an NFED center-fed, and another time it's an NFED center-fed dipole. And I can understand why it defies a very simple description, because it's NFED, but it acts as though it's a dipole, because of the common mode method that it's using for one of the dipole radiators. So this is rather fascinating. It does not require the standard 49-to-1 transforming balun that a regular half-wave end-fed wire requires. I don't know exactly what the efficiency of the high-Z choke would be, so I don't know whether it would be a win against an end-fed half-wave or not, but it certainly is fascinating.
Well, this is a very nice looking antenna, but it reminds me of something I saw on eBay. They were selling antennas, they call them J-poles, but they're made of wire, and you hang one end at the top, and then at the bottom there's a transmission line, maybe 16 feet or so, then you connect it to your radio or to your tuner, and they're different lengths and different size for different frequencies. Is this sort of similar to that?
Yeah, I think it is. They're not that different, right?
I would think that they're somewhat different in that a J-pole is basically a full half-wave end fed. The only difference is it's using that little J portion as a sub to tune it back to 50 ohms. So, whereas this fascinating little thing is using common mode and may have a radiation pattern more consistent with a dipole, J-poles are just sub-matched end-fed half-wave wires.
It's very nice antenna. Looking at the diagram, very nice. And, you know, I swear, you know, years ago, I thought, what would happen if, you know, I would take the braided part of the shield, you know, and I fold it down the coax and leave the I can't think of that, the center wire to stick out, you know, 16.6 inches. And then 16.6 inches of braid, and then the rest of transmission line, so it would be like a dipole, and then there would be no need for the high Z choke.
What if you had a braid?
I've actually had that same thought for a long time. If I have it. A couple of thoughts on the construction. One, yes, I have toyed for a long time with, I wouldn't like peel back the braid, but like I'd remove an additional 16 feet of the plastic covering, then I would try to get the center conductor out for a little hole, and I don't know, basically pull back the 16 feet of braid that, you know, I would normally cut off, and I would, here, this design, cut off and discard, and instead fold it back and just, you know, tape or tie wrap it to the coax, and I wonder how well that would work, and that's even simpler. A second thought I have is I would rather have something like this on 40 meters, and my reaction would be, obviously, you would double the length of the radiators, and I think that what you'd want to do is keep the choke design identical and resonate it at half the frequency. That would require 4 times the capacitor, or 330 puff would be fine, although he does use 1,000 volt capacitor. And I think you probably get some real high voltages at that point, so you wouldn't want to cheap out on that. But that's one thought. Another thought I had is if you really wanted to do this, I would think you might want to glue together something where it goes from coax to the center conductor, and instead use the that last exposed quarter wave of some more rigid wire, and put together something, slap something together to some rigidity, because I'd be worried about a center conductor of RG58 is not strong enough to support the weight of this whole thing. So I might want to actually use a piece of like 14 gauge stranded antenna wire and just, you know, like tie wrap everything down to a little block of plastic or something instead. So these are some thoughts I had. And Roy, any comments before I go into my heresy mode?
Yeah, in the magazine article, there's this interesting plastic material between the end of the coax and the wire. My guess would be it was some kind of strain relief. Otherwise, there would be a lot of damage to where the wire just meets the surface of the insulator. But yeah, theoretically, there's no real reason that you have to use the center wire for that part of the antenna. You can solder something much more sturdy to it and then take some kind of thermal plastic cone and fix them mechanically together. And that probably will give you the same function. Also, I think in his article he mentioned that he specifically felt that he had to increase the voltage breakdown rating for the capacitor if he wanted to get anywhere close to 100 watts transmission out of it. So, as I mentioned in my email, I would assume that if you're going to change the frequency in the capacitor, you're probably going to increase the Q and increase the voltage potential in that place. So you'd probably have to even make it sturdier than the guy designed his.
That you're going to get high voltages there, and you can't, you have to take it seriously, basically. All right, Roy, are you ready for me to show heresy now?
Yeah, except that David threw out his call, so you might want to ask him what he wanted to say.
Go ahead, David.
Well, you know, I played around with vertical dipoles. I took a couple of, what do they call those, these very small mobile antennas and, you know, put them on either side of a hamstick dipole mount. You know, played around with that, different angles and such. And I think there is an advantage for vertical antennas. And especially in the lower bands. So, yeah, I think your antenna diagram is very good and useful. And I say, you know, I had some ideas about it, and I hope that's okay.
Say you hope it's okay, you mean you're going to tell us these ideas?
I don't know. I'd say that on this TechNet, people get pretty excited about things, you know?
NY2H.
Who?
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around this thing. I'm looking at the article, and my question is, on the portion which is the quarter wave, not the bare wire, but the other part of the quarter wave, the 60 feet, 6 inches of coax, what's driving the coax? I know Roy alluded to common mode. I'm wondering if the choke is choking 20 meters, how is the outer shield beyond the choke being excited? And then I thought maybe it was the 82 puff capacitor was providing a way, but then that would negate the tanking of 20 meters. Then I thought maybe it was from the inner conductor through the dielectric. So how is the quarter wave with the shield on it radiating, and how is it being excited or fed?
My take is, yeah, this leads to the heresy I've been leaning towards. Imagine a 2 meter antenna mag mount on the trunk of a car. You have a quarter wave vertical working against the body of the automobile as the ground plane. In this case, can you say that the quarter wave of coax, the shield is acting as a ground plane, analogous to the way the car body does with the quarter wave vertical on 2 meters. And I can say he does show SWR plots, and he does get a pretty good SWR at the desired frequency, so apparently this is working, at least on the build. But here's where I go completely crazy. What happens if you leave off the choke entirely? I believe, and I haven't, I have done no calculations, no modeling it, no testing. I think the idea is that you have the entire length of the coax shield acting as a ground plane, just like the body of the car isn't resonant at 2 meters. And I think you might get a halfway decent SWR without playing any games with chokes at all. Now, you would not get my vertical dipole pattern, but as I've said on this net before, if you have this thing running through the trees, you're not going to get it no matter how hard you try. So maybe you should just give up on it, just accept what you have. I'm just wondering if anybody has any thoughts on that. Let's start with Roy, WB2EV.
I have a comment, Roy, when you get a chance. WY2U.
Okay, very good. Ed, like I sent you in the email, I would be concerned about the common mode reflections going back into whatever is driving the signal. I don't know. I guess some would like it, some wouldn't like it, some would fold over, and you'd have a decreased power output. It's an interesting question and would be an interesting experiment with someone else's equipment. And I just want to touch quickly on what Lou said. The sense I get from the article is that this is basically just an RF choke, a common mode RF choke. But because the author wants to keep everything as light as possible, he's using lightweight coax. He doesn't want to have a big, heavy, high impedance ferrite. He wants something relatively lighter, so he's offsetting the impedance of the inductor with a capacitor. And that's what he's doing, as opposed to more of a trapping circuit. Now, I'm not quite sure how that works, because in my mind, putting a parallel capacitor doesn't increase the impedance. It just gives you a tank circuit. But the wording that he uses, or my interpretation of it, sounds like he's producing the smallest possible common mode RF choke.
Yes, he's tanking only the outer shield, though.
Yes, because you don't want to do that to the center wire, because you need the center wire. He's actually just getting rid of the outer aspect of the outer shield. The differential mode transmissions going on the inner surface of the shield are still going on despite the RF choke.
KG2RY. WY2U.
Yes, WY2U.
Hi, Roy, this is Mike. Yeah, I got a little different spin on it, if I may. I'm viewing this antenna, believe it or not, I'm probably going to get some flack on this, but I'm viewing this antenna as a dipole, believe it or not. Now, the reason why I say that is, first of all, somebody's going to probably say, but the only exposed portion that seems to radiate is the topmost quarter wave section of the 16-foot center conductor. And I don't quite see it that way, because let's talk about why a transmission line like a coax does not radiate, or for that matter, why any transmission line does not radiate. Let me drop a minute. Whether it be coax, open wire line, twisted pair, whatever, the reason why these types of transmission lines do not radiate is because of a Faraday's law. When you send current down through one conductor, an equal and an opposite current is induced in the other conductor nearby in close proximity. If you make the spacing between these two conductors much, much smaller than a wavelength, the two currents are equal and opposite and radiation does not take place. That's pretty simple to understand. Now, in his particular case, what he's doing is he's forcing unequal currents in the shield and the center conductor by choking off a portion of the current. So instead of the currents canceling in this bottom section of what I'll call the outer shield, the quarter wave portion, he's actually made a dipole so that the current in that leg is made to be almost equal to the current on the top quarter wave section, hence you got a dipole. Now, the only question that may come up is, well, how the heck is he getting a good match? Because it seems like he's feeding it at the end, and I'm not sure that's the case either.